Three outs for State. Would Sweet call on Schartzer? Behind the backstop, a man wearing slacks and a short-sleeved button-down shirt and carrying a pencil and notebook watched and wondered. After 2 years of covering Macon over the phone, Joe Cook was only now seeing the Iron Men in person. Looking out at Sweet wearing what appeared to be a tie-dyed hat, he finally understood the grumblings. Ever since the end of the 1970 season, when Macon began winning, Cook had heard Decatur coaches complaining about Sweet. A conservative group, they thought it ridiculous that he allowed his players to have long hair, and more ridiculous that Sweet himself had it. "He's just a hippie with a bunch of farm boys," they told Cook. And at first, Cook had nodded along. Now, though, he wasn't so sure. After following Macon's route through the playoffs and watching the team in action, he thought maybe the hippie coach knew more than he let on. In this situation, though, Cook thought Sweet had to go to his ace. After all, Bloomington had already done so. What was stopping the Iron Men from doing the same? What's more, while Macon batted in the top of the seventh, Sweet had sent Schartzer down the right field line to warm up. Surely the coach would bring him in now, with so much at stake. Instead, with a pat on the shoulder, Sweet sent Henneberry back out to the mound. Sweet didn't need to say anything. He knew he had already sent the most powerful message he could. He'd warmed up Schartzer. In 2 seasons under Sweet, Schartzer had never relieved Henneberry, just as Henneberry had never relieved Schartzer. Some boys might have itched to enter the game in the late innings, to ride in for the chance at glory. But that's not how it worked with the Iron Men, or with Schartzer and Henneberry. Each took pride in finishing what they started, and pushing the other to do the same. Now Schartzer walked over to the mound and looked his friend in the eye. "God damn it, suck it up and get this done," he said to Henneberry. "I don't need to come in and do your job, just like you didn't come in and do mine." Henneberry nodded. This is how the boys had talked to each other for years. When Schartzer got in trouble in the past, it was Henneberry who sidled over to the mound. "Shark, your goddamn fastball looks like a beach ball coming in there," he'd say. To which Schartzer would retort, "Good, you skinny bastard. I'm going to throw it in and let them pull it right at you." And of course, Henneberry would then smile and said, "Yeah, baby, send it my way." This was different, though. This wasn't some podunk game on a crappy field against a bunch of farm boys. This was a chance to go to State. Still, Schartzer was right. This was no time for overthinking. Just suck it up and get this done. Bloomington sent up the top of its order in the seventh. Henneberry responded with a fusillade of curveballs. Down went leadoff hitter Brian Bird. Just suck it up and get it done. Then, solid contact. Bloomington had a man on second base. Shit. Up strode Cooper. Henneberry heard Bob Schartzer's voice in his head. He knew what he was supposed to do. Pitch around him. Instead, Henneberry unleashed a big, beautiful curveball. Strike one. Cooper had been ahead of the pitch, but he was too good a hitter not to adjust. No way I can get three in a row by him, Henneberry thought. He looked in, and behind the plate, Dean Otta was doing something unusual. Between his legs, Otta had put down 2 fingers. He was calling a pitch. Henneberry shook him off. Again, Otta put down 2 fingers. Throw the curve. Again, Henneberry shook him off. And so, with a man in scoring position, Henneberry came set and threw a fastball right down the pipe. Cooper wasn't fooled. He reared back and swung for the fences. There was a loud crack. Henneberry felt sick to his stomach. Only instead of soaring over his head, the ball shot into the backstop. Cooper had been dead on it and barely missed the pitch, fouling it straight back. Now, Hanabury knew what to do. This is what he'd spent all those afternoons in the backyard preparing for. At 0-2, he knew Cooper would expect him to waste a pitch. Hanabury looked over at Sweet. Sweet nodded back at him. In the back of his mind, Hanabury heard Bob Schartzer. Don't pitch to him. In the front of his mind, unavoidable, he heard Steve Schartzer, who was standing near third and of a different mind than his father.
Finish him right now, Goose, Steve yelled. Finish this big bastard off.
Hanabury kicked and delivered. The ball hung and then dropped out of the sky. Cooper unleashed a mighty swing. Strike three. Behind the Macon bench, Jack Hanabury nodded and clapped. All his boy needed was one more out for State. On the Bloomington bench, the players watched as Abfalder walked to the plate. A different thought, no doubt, ran through their minds. One big swing, and we're headed to State. Hanabury started out nibbling at the edge of the plate again, and soon it was 2-2. One strike away. With a runner in scoring position, Hanabury didn't want to take any chances. He had to end it on a strikeout. He went to his best pitch, a curveball that would tail inside to the left-handed Abfalder. Hanabury rocked, kicked, and fired. The ball tailed, just as it was supposed to. Only Abfalder did something he wasn't supposed to. With an inside-out swing, he pulled the ball, crushing it on the ground toward right field. At first base, Glenn dove, but couldn't get a glove on the ball. Hanabury's heart sank. Once the ball got to the outfield, the Bloomington runner, already on the move, would score. He'd been one strike away and blown it. And then, from out of nowhere, darted the form of Mark Miller. To this day, Hanabury has no idea how his friend covered that much ground. Out of respect for Abfalder's power, Miller had played the slugger exceptionally deep, standing on the edge of the outfield grass. Now, moving to his left, he speared the ball in short right as if snagging a passing bullet. Turning to throw to first, he encountered one small issue. No one was there. Glenn lay prone where his dive had taken him, a plume of dust encircling his head. Meanwhile, Hanabury, caught up in the moment, was standing like a statue on the mound. He'd forgotten to cover the base. All the while, Abfalder steamed down the line. With no other choice, Miller sprinted toward first. For the second time in the game, the two were on a collision course. Abfalder lunged. Miller leapt. Years later, Schartzer would call the sequence one of the top three plays I've ever been on the field for. Considering Schartzer's career, that would count as high praise indeed. By the slimmest of margins, Miller beat Abfalder to the bag, then slipped past him. Then, like a running back seeing daylight, Miller kept right on going as chaos erupted around him, sprinting through a hole in the fence all the way to the team bus. Hanabury followed, running as hard as he could, the roar of the Macon fans trailing him. Vaulting up the bus stairs, Hanabury saw Miller, who was standing in the aisle grinning, the ball still gripped in his right hand. Miller lifted it up and stuffed it into Hanabury's right hand while grabbing his friend's shoulder.
State, baby, State! He shouted.
Back on the diamond, the Macon fans were going nuts. Students rushed the field, swarming around Sweet. Parents walloped each other on the back, legs still shaky from the back-and-forth drama. Dick Jacobs, the Macon Little League coach, turned to his 58-year-old father, Myrtle. Dad, Dick said, you got any more of those heart pills? His father looked at him, surprised. Why? I think I need one. On the Bloomington bench, Coach Bob Spahn slumped, disbelieving. Macon had finished with only four hits, but still managed to win. On the field, the remaining Iron Men leapt and hugged and woo-hooed as only 16-year-old boys can. All except Schartzer, that is. He stood gripping his left wrist and grimacing. The injury had occurred in the fifth inning. After his RBI double, Schartzer tried to score on a single to the outfield. Halfway down the line, he realized he wasn't going to beat the throw. So he did what any super competitive athlete would. He tried to vault the catcher. Hurtling through the air, Schartzer had turned in an attempt to reach back and touch home plate. Before he could, he was tagged out. Then, milliseconds later, he'd landed and felt a sharp pain. In breaking his fall, he'd fractured a bone in his left hand. There was no time to worry about that, though. Out of the 700 high schools in Illinois, Macon was one of only 8 that were now headed to Peoria. It was a bus ride they'd remember the rest of their years. Schartzer sat in the back, hand clenched to his side, whooping like a pirate. Sweet was right there with him. The boys clapped, laughed, and roared. And then, somewhere along the hour-long drive, Stu started singing. In a bus full of giddy boys, the sound cut through the air, high and pure. Stu was the lead in all the plays and sang in choir. Decades later, his son would front a rock band, his voice just as sweet and melodic as his father's. They all recognized it instantly. The first song from Jesus Christ Superstar. Within seconds, Stu had company. First, it was Jeff Glenn, his voice almost as pure as Stu's. And then the rest of the boys joined. It was their song now. So when the line, "You really do believe this talk of God is true," came on, the boys instead sang, "You really do believe this talk of state is true." And instead of, "When do we ride into Jerusalem?" the boys sang, "When do we ride into Peoria?" Soon they were joined by the tape player, situated in the middle of the bus, as always, where Trussner was in charge of operating it. When King Herod's song came on, Schartzer yelled, "Take it away, Sam!" And Trussner leapt into the aisle to play the meanest air piano you've ever seen. And on it went, the bus rumbling through the gloaming of an Illinois spring night, a chorus of voices rising from the open windows. In the midst of it all, a dark-haired man who'd never intended to be a baseball coach closed his eyes for a moment and smiled. 16. Riding into Peoria. News travels fast in a town the size of Macon. By the time the players returned, it seemed everyone knew. The Iron Men were going to state. Meetings were interrupted. Card games stopped mid-deal. A small cheer went up at the country manor when the news was announced. This was big. Real big. Macon was the kind of town where, when the fire siren on the water tower went off, it was common to see a good portion of the townspeople grabbing their kids, hopping in their cars, and following the fire trucks to witness the blaze themselves, even if it was the middle of the night. Usually, the height of excitement every year was the Macon Play Day, held every summer in the small park across from Wiles Grocery Store and featuring food booths, Dunk the Dummy, a parade, and a Little Miss Macon baby contest. But going to state? As Jack Stringer would later say, this was the most exciting thing to hit Macon that anyone could remember. The team had nearly a week to savor the feeling before leaving for the tournament the following Wednesday. On Sunday, the Decatur Herald and Review named Steve Schartzer the Area Player of the Year. His stats were impressive, even by high school standards. A .412 batting average with 47 RBIs in 19 games. As a pitcher, he was 8-1 with a 1.74 ERA and 81 strikeouts in 61 innings. The coach of the year came as more of a surprise to some, especially the old coaches in Decatur. His name was Lynn Sweet, and, according to the Herald and Review, His mod style was a topic of conversation. Sweet marveled at how popular he'd suddenly become. All those parents who disapproved of his methods, all the school board members who thought him too rebellious, too wild, too different, now they patted him on the back.
"Good luck at State," they yelled in his ear. "Way to go, L.C.,"
they roared, while offering to buy him beers at the same bars they chastised him for frequenting only months earlier. A different type of man might have taken the opportunity to turn a cold shoulder, to exact verbal revenge. Sweet? He'd accepted the congratulations and patted back. He drank the beers and bought the next round. As the week wore on, Schartzer's hand continued to swell. Concerned, his parents took him to a local doctor, who confirmed what Steve already knew. His hand was out of commission. Treatment was discussed, but Schartzer would have none of it. "What are you going to do? Rub out a broken bone?" he asked. The way he saw it, since the injury was on his non-throwing hand, it was irrelevant. He'd be fine to pitch and could make do in the field. Hitting might be a challenge, but one he was certain he could overcome. After all, he had no other choice. Across town, another member of the Iron Men dealt with a different diagnosis. All week, Brian Snitker had kept tabs on his father, who remained under observation at St. Mary's Hospital. The heart attack had occurred on the night of the Bloomington game. While the kids rode back on the bus, Dick Snitker drove the same road in the family station wagon, his wife Catherine beside him and Brian's two younger sisters, Angela and Andrea, in the back seat. Halfway back to Macon, Dick had complained of shooting pains in his arms. Upon returning home, he'd gone straight to bed while Catherine called their doctor, who hurried to the Snitkers' two-story house on West Height Street in southwest Macon. Upstairs, he found Dick Snitker lying in bed, looking pale, but claiming to be just fine. He just had some chest pain, that was all. The doctor disagreed. "We need to get you to a hospital, Dick." The next morning, Dick Snitker got the news. He'd suffered a minor heart attack, and would need to stay in the hospital for a week, maybe longer. Dick was not pleased. Over the course of the season, the Snitkers had grown especially close to the team. With the rare exception of when Dick was on the road for work, they'd attended every game, and their home had become the Iron Men's unofficial hangout. Almost every evening, Brian brought home teammates to eat his mom's cooking. Spaghetti one night, fried chicken and fresh corn from the Wells farm the next. It got so the boys didn't even knock on the Snitker front door. They just ambled in. Stu Arnold even said, "Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad." While the boys came for Catherine's dinners, the baseball parents came for the company. Dick was personable and took entertaining seriously, as any man who's worked for Jim Beam and Pabst might. His refrigerator was always thick with beer, and one wall of his garage constituted both his work inventory and the largest liquor cabinet in central Illinois. Over two seasons' worth of drinks and meals, the Snitkers had come to view the players and their parents as one big extended family. The fact that Dick had helped engineer Sweet's return to coaching only cemented the bond. And now, the doctors were telling Dick that he had to stay in the hospital during the tournament. Even though his own son would be playing. Even though only 8 teams in the entire state of Illinois made it. Even though no one in their right mind ever expected a team from Macon to go this far. At 5 p.m. on Tuesday, the eve of the Iron Men's trip to Peoria, the phone rang at the Henneberry house. When Betty Henneberry answered, she looked surprised. She told the caller to hold on, then walked to the backyard, where John and Dean Otta were playing a lazy game of catch. "It's for you, John." John tossed the ball to Dean and jogged in, expecting to hear one of his cousins from Decatur on the other end of the line. but when he picked up the phone, he heard not a Henneberry, but the scratchy voice of an adult.
John, this is Joe Cook from the Decatur Herald and Review. I'd like to talk to you about the state tournament.
Henneberry froze. He'd played three sports at Macon for the better part of 4 years, but this was the first time anyone from a newspaper had wanted to talk to him. Hell, not even the Iron Man scene had interviewed him. He had, he realized.